In the matter of the investigation of burglary and theft, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Your Honor, Shiraz Lee, Assistant Ocean County Prosecutor, on behalf of the State.
Good morning, Your Honor. Deputy Attorney General, I.L.D. Leonard, Deputy Attorney General, and Attorney General.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Brian
Keene,
Assistant
Deputy Court Defender, for
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Mr. Dean, please go ahead.
Your Honors, before I begin, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine.
May it please the Court. This case is about the State's attempt to test the strength of its evidence prior to making an arrest based off an incomplete investigation. Now, we sought an investigative detention of JP pursuant to Rule 35A because we believe that this course provided the best balance between JP's Fourth Amendment rights and the State's interest in investigating the burglary at issue. However, the trial and appellate courts ultimately held that the State failed to satisfy Rule 35A-4 because they already had access, because the State already had access to JP's DNA in the CODIS database. The courts went on to say that the State would be able to pursue another application for JP's DNA, perhaps in a more favorable light in the post-arrest context. Now I'd like to discuss three closely related problems with the lower court's reasoning. First, the lower court's decision contradicts the entire purpose of a pre-arrest investigative detention, which is to advance the State's investigation before making an arrest based on it. Second, the lower court's misinterpreted subsection D of Rule 35A-4. And third, the lower court's consideration of a future arrest was inappropriate and premature in the context of Rule 35A. And one other concept that I believe is relevant to all three of these arguments, which bears explication, is the distinction between information and evidence. Now, there's no question that the State has access to the information of JP's DNA. That's because DNA doesn't change. A sample taken today contains exactly the same information as a sample taken 3 years ago. It contains exact information as a sample taken 3 years from now. But every sample has its own unique evidential value. And the evidential value of the sample that the State requested under 35A is that we can establish a chain of custody and use it for confirmation testing. And when the State's opinion is that the lower courts conflated these two concepts in making their decision, which led to an illogical dichotomy in their reasoning. Namely, the appellate court essentially stated, State, we agree with you that there is a valid purpose for confirmatory testing, that it will in fact advance your investigation pursuant to Rule 35A-4, subsection C. However, we can't grant you an investigative detention because you already have access to the information of JP's DNA in the CODIS database. But then the court goes on to say, in the post-arrest context, despite the fact that you still have exact same access to the same CODIS information in the database, State now will allow the court to grant a detention for the purpose of obtaining that same DNA, which we just said that you already have access to, because its evidential value is significant. The State is asking this court to resolve that dichotomy and properly rule that the State properly satisfied all the requirements of Rule 35A and that we do need a new evidential sample of JP's DNA. This concludes my opening statement. Now, turning first to the purpose of a pre-arrest investigatory...
Can I ask you a question?
Certainly.
Does the State have DNA in the state police laboratory that it could retest this defendant's DNA?
Not pursuant to the CODIS manual. The CODIS manual specifically demands that it be a new sample.
Forget about the CODIS manual. Okay, forget about that. Does the State have possession of the defendant's DNA, some DNA sample, in a state police laboratory?
We only have the reference sample, which has been already been uploaded to the CODIS database. So in the state system, to my knowledge, that there is no sample other than that reference
sample. Okay, so there's no sample that could be retested. Is that what you're representing to us?
I believe that is the case, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
So tell us why the manual requires what it does. It plainly says we need another sample. What's the reason for that?
Well, the manual is trying to enact a safeguard against the possibility of human error because there is no chain of custody with respect to DNA samples that are taken from police departments across the entire state. They're simply taken by jailhouse personnel, they're mailed to the CODIS lab, and then they're tested for their accuracy there and inputted into the system.
But there was a match, right?
It was a match, Your Honor, correct.
And DNA is immutable. So it's not going to change. I don't understand where the issue arises.
The issue arises in that we need to establish a chain of custody because we don't know if there was some sort of error at the jailhouse level. Let's say that the jailhouse technician dropped a vial of somebody else's because they take 15,000 of these samples approximately a year. there's no way the CODIS technician would know that that error had happened if there was an error during the processing in the ordinary postal mail.
But doesn't the fact that there's a match indicate that there was no error?
The match is simply to the paperwork listed under the jailhouse that they submit to the laboratory. So if the jailhouse is representing this is the person who this DNA belongs to, the CODIS laboratory has no recourse but to say that this is the person.
You don't have to bring everyone in the chain of custody to court, correct?
I'm sorry.
You do not have to bring every person in the chain of custody to court, do you?
I don't believe we do here.
Why can't the state hand deliver these samples to the state police lab, so there will be a chain of custody in the future?
It's a question of practicality, Judge. Again, we're talking about 15,000 samples approximately per year, so it's just simply not feasible for counties such as Cape May and Sussex to send a never-ending caravan of police officers for every single sample, because a sample is taken not just for evidentiary analysis. A sample is taken, these samples that were at issue are samples taken pursuant to the statute requiring samples to be taken upon conviction of any crime or arrest for first, second, and certain enumerated offenses. We don't have the manpower or the resources, and I don't think there's a state agency in this state which is going to say that they have three people that they can spare to, you know, send, again, never ending, every single day they would have to transport these samples by hand to Trenton and backwards. They can't process it within the police station.
So CODIS, you're not in any position to change the way CODIS does business, obviously.
No, and again, this is a standard that's not a unique New Jersey standard. This is a federally standard that's operated in all 50 states. All the CODIS personnel are acknowledging that no state really has the resources to do so, which is why they require a new sample to be taken from the person so that they can establish chain of custody, because they acknowledge that it's simply not feasible.
Is there any reason in addition to chain of custody?
Chain of custody is the primary reason, but we're also talking about a redundancy here, another new round of testing for evidentiary analysis. And DNA is powerful evidence. It's not something like a glove or a hat where you can just eyeball it and say, well, this doesn't match. Only the laboratory technician has the ability to analyze it. And when it gets to trial, he's going to testify, you know, there's one in however many billion chance that somebody else other than this person possessed, in this case, a glove. So it's in everybody's best interest, and I think the FBI acknowledged that when they created these safeguards, to make sure that the evidence that we're presenting actually implicates the person.
And in fact, the defendant would be very quick to point out a lack of chain of custody, it's in the U.S. mail, no one has any idea who handled it, et cetera.
Precisely.
If that original match were presented as evidence.
Precisely. And our CODIS personnel, when they send a letter to us, and the letter that was submitted, it doesn't say that this is evidence. It says that this sample, the initial match, is simply an investigative lead. That's the terminology that the CODIS personnel are sending to the law enforcement agency, and that's what the defense attorney would bring out at trial. And that's out of acknowledgement that there could be an error here, and the FBI does not want people representing that an unconfirmed match is evidence.
It wasn't one of the things the court said is no one's challenging chain of custody at this point.
See, the problem with that reasoning, Your Honor, is that we wouldn't have any reason to know that there was a chain of custody defect until there's another round of testing.
Is the court implying that you should be filing a motion in limine, raising that question pretrial, and is that an issue or a problem for the prosecutor?
The issue with that, Your Honor, is that the reason that we want to do this pre-arrest and not post-arrest, pre-trial, is that we have the opportunity here to vet our evidence before we make an arrest. And that's not always the case. There's often the case that we have to proceed on some minimum threshold of probable cause simply because of a threat of public safety. But here, why would we act on evidence before ensuring that the safeguards that we're required to enact anyway? Again, there's no question, and I think the lower courts were on the same page here, that this evidence will be subject to confirmatory testing at some point.
But wouldn't you be in a better position? Isn't this something the court raised, that if you said, chain of custody, this is what we have, we're asking the court for a declaration, see if they challenge it, and if they challenge it, then you go back to court, you have an argument.
It's not simply trial admissibility that we're concerned with, because it's an easy thing to overlook, but when we're talking about chain of custody, by very definition, as we put in the state's brief, we're talking about being more certain that the person that the evidence is implicating is in fact the person that is actually committed whatever offense it is.
Can I ask you one other question?
Absolutely.
He's already in custody for other robberies.
Correct.
His DNA has been taken in connection with those other robberies.
His DNA was taken in connection with the first robbery, which is what was uploaded to the CODIS system. The DNA from the second system, if it was properly handled, it should never have been taken if it was a New Jersey offense, as we believe it was. It would have been destroyed.
That's not really my question. My question is, he's in custody. Does that impact the privacy interest analysis, the search analysis that he is already in custody? And secondarily, don't you have enough based upon the CODIS hit and the other evidence you have, the witness, the gloves, to get a warrant for his DNA?
We could potentially get a warrant, Your Honor, but the state has the ability to proceed on the investigative detention, which is a lesser evidentiary standard. The state should be entitled to...
My first question. He's in custody.
Correct, Your Honor.
He's in detention. Does that in any way affect the analysis?
I don't think it does, Your Honor. I think the analysis is independent of any sort of privacy balancing interest. It simply asks whether or not the state's requested intrusion is reasonable and will lead to evidence, and there's no other means to get it.
And once the court said, no, you can't do it, why didn't the prosecutor, rather than appealing and seeking this, going through this process, simply take the warrant to the judge, say, here's our probable cause, let us take a swab?
Well, we think it's an important issue, Judge, to be able to determine whether or not we can proceed on these investigative detentions. And we have the time in this case. It's going to be relevant for all future cases.
Do you want a ruling in this case so that you don't have to present warrants in the future?
That's possibly the case. It may be the case. Now, we believe we have probable cause in this case, but that may not always be the case.
Are you suggesting that for a buccal swab under the court rule, you don't have to have probable cause?
It's a lesser standard than probable cause. It's a reasonable, well-grounded basis.
Well, Hall said that applies to searches that are akin to fingerprinting and things of the like, but we've said buccal swab's a search that requires probable cause.
It's a minor intrusion, Your Honor, and we think that the buccal swab context is more appropriate to the reasonable, well-grounded basis, considering that it was added to the Rule 35A.
But it's being used for a criminal purpose to zone in on a particular individual. This is not an identification purpose. This is a criminal investigatory purpose.
And the criminal investigatory purpose is built into an investigation purpose, is built into the very text of Rule 358-4, subsection
C. I think you're
C.
misreading Hall. I think you're overlooking very important language in Hall and a probable cause requirement in Gathers.
Even if we have a probable cause requirement, Your Honor, that doesn't change the analysis that the lower courts undertook with respect to this particular issue.
Mm-hmm.
We believe that we do have probable cause in this case. We could meet that evidential threshold. We still think that a reasonable, well-grounded basis is the text applied, but even if we were wrong on that front, we still demonstrated, and the lower courts agreed, that we met subsection C of Rule 358-4C.
I didn't think that was a quarrel here. May I ask you a different question? There's an argument that's being made under the statute, 53-1:20-22, that defendant is saying the state cannot take a DNA sample twice under subsection D. Now, that says no sample shall be drawn or collected pursuant to Section 4, that's 53-1:20.20, if they've previously taken a blood or biological sample from a person. But that cross-reference has an exception for another DNA sample being taken by judicial order. So
correct.
Do you read that exception as covering your situation?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Okay. That particular statute that you're referencing was simply designed so that there aren't repetitive samples taken for convictions as pursuant to that statute. For example, in this case, it wouldn't have been allowed to take a sample for the 2018 conviction.
Right.
We don't want a sample every single time. We only want one reference sample and then one confirmatory sample for evidentiary analysis.
And I think that's consistent with your argument that there are two different purposes, the identification purpose and database design of the DNA statute that fits with the federal scheme, and the investigatory purpose that you're invoking under the court rule.
Absolutely.
Correct? Okay.
You've suggested that the confirmatory sample, the second sample, is needed, and I'm paraphrasing, to make sure that it was done right the first time. Is the testing any different?
To my knowledge, the testing would be very similar, Your Honor. I'm not entirely certain if there's any material difference, scientifically speaking. But
is there any difference in the testing itself?
I wouldn't believe that there is. I think that what we're interested in here is establishing chain of custody to know that this sample is correct, and then establishing a redundancy by conducting another round of testing on this new sample. So just in case that there was any laboratory error in the first testing, that would be revealed by the second round of testing.
So the problem with the second reason is, why wouldn't it then justify a third and a fourth sample?
We're only required to do the one, and we are required. This isn't optional. The FBI requires it.
And then isn't your argument just that? We're required to do it under federal law, and we want to establish chain of custody, not the additional reason that you're proffering.
The reason that the FBI requires this, in part, is that we're interested in establishing that this person who committed this offense, who we have DNA evidence, this initial investigative lead, tying him to this glove, is in fact the person who committed this crime. Now, we think that if we could test this 1,000 times in a perfect world, we would. But twice is at very least eliminates the possibility of error to such a low degree that we're reasonably confident to proceed on this evidence.
Would you agree that if you had a prior sample that was hand-delivered, analyzed by scientist, technician in the state police lab, that technician or scientist was available to testify, that under those circumstances you wouldn't be able to take a second sample, either under the rule or even under the Constitution, because that would not be a reasonable search?
If there was a second sample which was sufficient, it could be used for confirmatory testing, which I believe if it was a documented chain of custody, if it was delivered to the lab and treated as an evidentiary sample, absolutely. I don't think that the state would be entitled to. I think a judge would look at this and say, what is the purpose of this? It's for confirmatory testing, and that's when subsection D would apply, because the evidentiary significance of that sample would be identical to the one that the state
It would probably apply under the rule and probably under our Constitution as well.
Absolutely. And under the Fourth Amendment, it would be potentially be an unreasonably search and seizure.
Tell me what I'm missing about the process here. Why couldn't the county prosecutor's offices keep a reference sample? In other words, send the reference sample that becomes the initial CODA sample, keep a sample just simply labeled appropriately, so you don't even have a chain of custody in terms of transmission. You say it was taken on this day, and you have that documented. And then if an issue like this comes up, you get a CODIS hit, you then have a sample as to which you could create a chain of custody.
Your Honor, I'm not entirely certain that the scientific reasons why we couldn't store a particular buccal swab. All I know is that the state police is the only agency that we know that is capable of processing these samples correctly and ensuring that.
I understand processing, but I'm just talking about pure storage. I mean, obviously, you take the sample, it's presumably put into a test tube and labeled, and then you send it off. How about keeping some of that? Obviously, there's no doubt a protocol for how to maintain the integrity of the DNA, keeping some of that, and then you can just wait until to see if you do get a CODIS hit, and then you have no problem with chain of custody.
Well, we are talking about another intrusion. For as minor as a buccal swab intrusion is, making two is greater than one for the
protocol. You were dividing the sample somehow. You have two swabs with a Q-tip.
I don't know that would be a violation of scientific protocol to rip apart Q-tip and allow for that. Right. I would have to.
See what I'm saying is that it seems like the practical problem here of the inability, and it's understandable to have hundreds of thousands, presumably CODIS samples, all subject to a chain of custody, could be dealt with at the source.
But here's another consideration, Your Honor, which is that what we're ultimately concerned with is potential human error at the jailhouse level. Now, if they took the wrong paperwork, split that sample up, and put it into another envelope, that same error lies undetected. And now we have the false confidence that this is, in fact, another sample when it, in fact, is actually tied to the same
person. Well, then it's not going to be matched the second time around if it's somebody else's. So there.
And we would only find that out through confirmatory testing. If we tested that same sample and used that for confirmatory testing, then it would be a match. It absolutely. We would be transporting that to the NJSAP. They'll say this is exactly the same as the other one, despite the protocol, and we would be proceeding on a false sense of confidence. That would be potentially even worse than what we have going now, which is at least establishing that another round of testing is required.
Do county prosecutors today have the ability to store the materials along the lines of what we were just discussing?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. I would have to speak with the scientific personnel again with respect to that. As far as I know, the NJCP is the only agency which is able to, at the very least, process this information. If a second swab, could we keep a swab in a vial? Absolutely. Is that sufficient scientifically to meet all the safeguards and requirements? I couldn't answer that question to you right now. I would suspect that it wouldn't, considering the way we've been treating this evidence. The fact that the FBI doesn't require that, I think, speaks to the fact that
it wouldn't be a question of just storing it in a storeroom somewhere. You'd have to establish some methods, some chain of custody within the samples at the prosecutor's office or at the police station. Would that create some logistics problems?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I mean, again, we're talking about 15,000 samples per year, and we're talking about...
And that's statewide.
That's statewide.
How about your office?
We don't have 15,000 convictions per year. But when we're talking about how many samples are used for evidentiary analysis, the number is in 600 or so, in that ballpark. So we're talking about a minor percentage. It really is of a practical significance to have a confirmatory testing after a crime has been committed, after a CODIS hit has been hit. It only makes sense. We have to act within the realm of rationality and practicality here.
Does the same problem present itself when it's a federal investigation? One of the local FBI offices obtains evidence through a buccal swab and then sends it to the lab. Do they need to get a second sample?
I would have to imagine that they would, because the FBI is also bound by the NDIS procedure. They can't ignore it any more than we can.
And they're not storing it or taking measures to safeguard materials within the local field offices?
As far as I'm aware, they're not. I mean, again, I'm not an expert in this particular subset, but to my knowledge, I would think that they would be required to proceed with simply the NDIS manual procedures as set forth, because they were supposed to be applicable nationwide. And for the FBI to simply say, we've kept our own sample, we don't need to go ahead with this confirmation testing process, I think would be a departure which would have been provided for in the manual itself.
Has that been challenged, the taking of the second sample on the federal level?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. Again, this issue is incredibly rare. In our experience, if a sample is requested, it's normally granted via investigative detention. It's only recently that this has become an issue, and there's very little case law on the actual topic itself.
The evidence in this case is the DNA on the gloves. Without that, you have no case, correct?
We have some evidence in terms of the vague description, but in terms of primary strength of our evidence, it is a significant linchpin, Your Honor.
And you want to make an identification before you charge him rather than after.
Absolutely.
That's why you want to do it now.
And that only makes sense for for the person of interest right now. And when we're talking about a practical difference for this person, for a pre-arrest investigative detention for a swab or a post-arrest, we're talking about him being transported from the jail in a pre-arrest situation to the medical wing, he's swabbed and sent on his way. In the post-arrest situation, he's transported from the jail to the medical wing, swabbed, and he's sent on his way. There's virtually no difference except for the timing, except now we have the ability to determine whether or not this is going to be a wrongful arrest before it happens. The state is willing to withhold an arrest. The courts are telling us go ahead with the most significant Fourth Amendment intrusion possible, rather than conduct what is possibly one of the most minimal intrusions possible, which is subject to all the safeguards set forth in state law. And when we look to why the court made that decision, we're looking at the rule itself, and the court engaged in a very lengthy analysis with respect to the differences in Fourth Amendment rights pre- and post-arrest, but all of that was essentially dicta, because when you actually look to the actual holding of the court, the actual legal reason that the state did not succeed in its Rule 35A application, well then you had, and I quote, "The state has yet to demonstrate that it will not be practicable to make evidential use of the original sample taken from him previously in 2015 or the 2018 sample." They're saying it's just a failure of subsection D of Rule 35A-4. And subsection D is a factual question. Whether or not the state has a practical avenue is simply a matter of fact. Does the state possess an access to this or not? And the answer to that fact has to be no.
Your position is, what sense does it make to arrest him, as the appellate division is suggesting, based on the CODIS hit, and merely to take the test afterwards to find out whether it's confirmatory?
Correct.
Like, why do that? It makes no sense.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And there is significant damage. Let's say the worst case scenario. And we've never had a situation. We have no reason to believe that the hit will not be confirmed. But let's say this is the first case, and we find out that it's not actually JP's DNA in the database. It's somebody else. How do we explain to JP, who 3 years down, or how long it takes to get this confirmatory result, that we in New Jersey thought we knew better than the federal protocols, the standard safeguards that were put in place, and we ignored them simply because we thought that what we had was good enough? We have the ability here. The text of the rule specifically states that the state has to have a viable alternative, which we don't have at this stage. And so not only does basic principles of reason, but also the text of the rule itself is against the lower court's decisions and should be reversed.
Just one last question on procedure. If you were to get a second sample, what would you do to establish a chain of custody that you need to get this into evidence?
We would send an officer down
to
there.
To the state police?
He would personally drive that up to Trenton and hand deliver it over to the NJSA.
Okay, and then the NJS, the New Jersey State Police, would provide a chain of custody to the upload for CODIS, and then presumably that's all you need?
Correct. And in fact, the memo that's provided in the state's brief establishes that there's even different kits that are used. I don't know that there's a scientific difference between the kits, but at the very least it's flagged that this is an evidentiary analysis, not a reference sample, and potentially more safeguards and heightened caution will be employed during the transportation process.
Anything you'd like to add?
Yes, Your Honor. When we were talking, again, with respect to the rule-based analysis, we think that the problem with the appellate division's analysis is that the rules have to be read in harmony. Subsection D can't be read on its own. It has to be read within the context of the other subsections. And the way the appellate division has read it is that the state can possess another practicable means to access the evidence that doesn't meet the goal that it set forth in subsection C. So the state could have a viable reason to have this evidence, the state could have a viable investigatory objective, and still be foreclosed from proceeding on it just because it has access to another similar piece of information which isn't sufficient for that analysis. And the state believes that that can't possibly be correct. Subsection D was created as a lesser intrusive catch-all. It's designed for the purpose of saying, state, do you have access to another means which doesn't require court order, which doesn't require intrusion, to achieve your legitimate law enforcement goal? And the answer to that question is no. And specifically, I'd point to the State v. Hall when we're talking about the origin of this rule. Specifically, the court says, additionally, it must be shown that the results of the detention will significantly advance the criminal investigation and will serve to determine whether or not the suspect probably committed the crime. Further, it must also appear that these investigative results cannot otherwise be practically be obtained. These results, which will advance the investigation. Now, that's not the case for a sample in the CODIS database. That's not going to advance the investigation whatsoever. So when we're talking about the interpretation of what does otherwise practically obtain mean, it has to mean a sample which can meet the requirements of subsection C. Otherwise, we're taking form over substance and destroying the purpose of the rule for the citing solely to a provision which was intended as a catch-all. Furthermore, and lastly, I would like to take, and this isn't exactly what the appellate division said, but this is something that they considered and the trial court considers as heavily on their mind, which was they looked to the future of a potential future arrest in making a determination on Rule 35A. In fact, most of the appellate division decision is focused on the balance of JP's rights in a future arrest context versus now. But it's not the role of the judiciary to determine whether or not there will be arrest. Notwithstanding the fact that we have probable cause, there's often cases where we have probable cause that a crime has been committed and don't proceed with an arrest.
Excuse me.
No, sorry.
No question. Sneezing.
My apologies. It could be the case that we're interested in JP as part of a larger investigation. It could be that we believe that somebody else fits a certain profile that could be committing this crime. We might want to explore these leads. We may not be able to arrest JP. But by the appellate division taking that analysis that, well, of course you have probable cause, you're going to arrest this person, they're overstepping the role of the courts in the Fourth Amendment context. It's not the case in a search warrant context.
You don't know. Your argument is if it was non-confirmatory, you wouldn't arrest them.
Not necessarily. The point is if it
you
was...
Would? If those blue gloves came back to someone else's DNA, you're still going to arrest them?
Oh, absolutely not, Your Honor. If the blue gloves came out to somebody else's DNA, but even if they come back to his DNA, that doesn't mean that we're going to arrest, but we wouldn't be able to achieve confirmatory testing if the appellate division is looking towards the future arrest as a possibility to meet the requirements of subsection D, which it seemed like they were via their decision. Notwithstanding, they didn't say those exact words. In fact, a question that was asked during oral argument repeatedly was, don't you have probable cause to arrest? It's a focus on the appellate courts. It's a focus on the trial.
Your argument is the decision to arrest should be made on the basis of the criteria that are normally applied to it and not simply because it's a way to get a sample.
Absolutely, because our detectives, our investigative staff have access to information that isn't necessarily provided to the court in determining whether or not there will be arrest. They may have doubts about the witness's testimony, who is the sole linchpin providing the link between the gloves and JP, and they may want to follow
you're
up.
You're not commanded to make an arrest merely because you have probable cause. The state is permitted to continue its investigation and strengthen its case to make more certain that they have the right, that it has the right person.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Okay. That's the point that we're trying to make here. So, in conclusion, the state would simply note that basic principles of reason dictate that when the state is willing to forestall in this circumstance, when the state is willing to withhold the most significant Fourth Amendment intrusion possible, it should be afforded the opportunity to make a minimal intrusion simply to ascertain that the powerful evidence of DNA is directed at the right person and that justice is achieved in this case, not only for our investigation, but for the person of interest as well.
Thank you, Mr. Dean.
Thank you.
Ms. Hunter.
Good morning. May it please the court. The appellate division decision should be reversed for two reasons. First, the panel misunderstands the CODIS requirement for reference samples and incorrectly determined that the previous samples taken from the defendant could practicably be obtained by the state. And second, the opinion effectively eviscerates Rule 35A4 for purposes of obtaining a buccal swab. Regarding the first issue, the appellate panel and the trial court have overcomplicated what is a very straightforward and simple issue. Chapter 6 of the INDIS Operational Procedures Manual mandates that every single time the state lab gets a DNA hit from a profile on a piece of evidence and matches to a DNA profile stored in CODIS, a DNA sample must subsequently be obtained as a reference sample to be compared to confirm that match. That's in every single case in every single state that participates in the CODIS program. This is an intentional redundancy as a safeguard for the defendant, and the notion that we could practically obtain the sample that was already taken from the defendant and entered into CODIS as a comparison, that's comparing what we already have, so that's not a confirmation. That's just simply retesting the exact same sample that was previously submitted. And it's not a mere convenience of the state that we mail the offender samples. It would be absolutely unfeasible for the state to hand deliver every single buccal swab that is taken from an arrestee or a convicted offender. The state lab, so far this year, as of October 18th of this year, the lab has received 11,527 offender samples. More than 1,000 of those have come from Essex County. More than 1,000 of those came from Passaic County. There's no way these law enforcement agencies could hand deliver 1,000 samples plus every single year. In addition to that, there's no way to explain a match to a jury if we use what's previously in CODIS. If we were to use the previous sample, we can never explain to a jury, well, we got a DNA match to DNA that was stored in CODIS, because we can't prejudice the jury against the defendant in that way. And an additional consideration is that because this is a national program, even if in New Jersey we changed the procedure and hand-delivered every single buccal swab that was taken from any offender, we can't control the chain of custody rules in other states. And in particular in New Jersey, when we're in a tri-state area, we often have offenders whose prior sample was taken in New York or Pennsylvania. We can't establish their chain of custody. And sometimes we have a hit on a DNA profile that was, you know, 20 years old. We can't necessarily establish chain of custody there, because the person who entered that into the database may not be available anymore. And so if we did hand deliver all of those thousands of samples every single year, what would end up happening is the law enforcement agencies would hold the samples until they could justify the drive, and so they would wait until they had 5 or 20 or, you know, however many samples, or they would go once a month or every 6 weeks. And, you know, some of these arrestee samples are only taken for violent crimes. And so we can't wait for violent crimes to be unsolved for weeks. This would lead to an increase in violent crime if we were to radically change our procedures and go this route. And by comparison, while we get anywhere between 15,000 and 20,000 offender samples every year, they typically get between 800 and 1,000 reference samples per year. And so that disparity goes toward the argument that it's not, it wouldn't make sense to get two samples every single time we swab somebody and send one off in the offender kit that CODIS provides to the lab and then store one in evidence, because we just, it's such a small percentage of the samples that are taken. And then to my second point, by saying that the state has met A through C of Rule 35A4, but that we can't practicably obtain the DNA sample unless we arrest the defendant, that eviscerates the purpose of the rule and will always be in search warrant territory if we're always going to arrest somebody if we can meet A through C. The only way to practically obtain a buccal swab is to get, and under this rule, is to get a reference sample that is taken and follows the chain of custody and the procedure that has been followed since the beginning of CODIS in New Jersey.
Can you respond to Justice LaVecchia's earlier question? 35A4 has a lesser standard than probable cause. Do you need to show probable cause to get a buccal swab?
We do not.
Why?
Rule 35A4 was a reaction to State v. Hall, and it, out of that, they came up with this is a reasonable and well-grounded basis to believe, which is less than probable cause. And even though in State v. Gathers, probable cause was required, that was because Gathers, the request for his buccal swab was made 5 months after his indictment. And so that's no longer in Rule 358 territory. That was in post-arrest and therefore the probable cause territory.
What about O'Hagan? Was that similar? I'm not sure that it was in the post-arrest situation.
I'm not sure if that was post-arrest, but I know that the court there addressed that this was a special needs consideration.
Well, it rejected the special needs analysis.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah.
But the point is that there's this, the Rule 35A is different from post-arrest buccal swabs.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason that that rule was created, so that it creates a dichotomy of this is just pre-arrest investigation versus post-arrest. We're in a more serious territory looking to buccal
swabs. Maybe you can help me with this. In Justice Handler's opinion in Hall, he covers a great amount of information, and when he creates this paradigm for pre-arrest investigations and say this is within the court's jurisdiction to be able to assist the state in this way, he relied heavily on ALI Section 170 and its analogous procedures for pre-arrest detentions and investigations. And in two places in footnotes, and in each, he was careful to delineate between the fingerprinting or a lineup situation, which is what Hall was considering, and the level of intrusiveness that was involved in taking someone in a pre-arrest situation, bringing them in for that kind of non-intrusive investigation to further the state's cause. But he has that footnote that says we're not reaching other procedures that are not of the same level of intrusion as fingerprinting. And he cites to that Section 170, and in that Section 170, they list blood tests, urine tests, biological samples generally, as if they are in a separate subsection. So it's from that language and that hesitancy in Hall not to go that far and say that for all purposes, reasonable and articulable suspicion is enough. I feel that the court has never quite reached the conclusion that you're asking us to reach here, that in a pre-arrest situation, probable cause or something more than reasonable articulable suspicion would be the right standard for a buccal swab specifically. I don't think that we've quite answered it as directly as you're suggesting.
That may be correct, but then the court rule came out of this case, and instead of saying probable cause, it says a reasonable and well-grounded basis.
Which is what Hall said.
And also, I'd like to point out that in Maryland v. King, it does, the United States Supreme Court there compared a buccal swab to fingerprinting.
Well, Maryland King is an entirely different situation. That statute is being used for identification purposes, not for criminal investigation purposes.
But
so I think Scalia's statements that are taken frequently from that opinion are being used out of context.
I think the proposition stands for the same, that this is a very minor intrusion that we're asking for a defendant. And what we're doing is we have a DNA match, and all we need is confirmation of that match. And so the lower standard is appropriate, and I think that's why it's worded the way that it is. It doesn't say probable cause.
That doesn't lower the intrusion. So well-grounded suspicion to believe that a person has committed a crime, that's probable cause. That's this correct?
Not precisely, because I think the language is different for a reason.
No, we've said that many times. This is written slightly different.
Shouldn't it be probable cause for a search, not probable cause for arrest, right? Probable cause that evidence of criminality is going to be obtained as a result of the search, because the buccal swab is a search.
Correct. So it is for the search, but I don't think the probable cause is required, or that language isn't found in the rule. And so I think there's a reason for that. It's that we're talking about pre-arrest, and when we have a DNA match, and I asked the CODIS administrator, does it ever happen that we get a sample and the reference sample doesn't match? And it doesn't. Mm-hmm. We've never had that happen. And so this is very powerful evidence, but we haven't arrested yet. We're just confirming what we already know. And so I think there's a good reason there for not requiring probable cause at this point.
I just want to go back to what is probable cause for a second, so we're all on the same page here. I'm just quoting like one of our cases, but it's been repeated countless times. Probable cause exists if at the time of the police action there is a well-grounded suspicion that a crime has been or is being committed. Probable cause, correct?
That's correct. I don't disagree with that.
The difference with B, the well-grounded basis, it's that it goes on to say, believe that the person sought may have committed the crime rather than did commit the crime. That's what brings us down to something less than probable cause, correct?
I think that's right.
So I just want to follow up with a question that Justice Lavecchia asked, and this has to do with the nature of the intrusion and also the potential constitutionality of B in 3584, which may not be directly before us because we seem to be dealing mostly with D. But in terms of a blood sample, that is a very serious intrusion. Would you not agree?
I'd agree that it's certainly more intrusive than a cotton swab in the mouth.
And a whole lot more intrusive than fingerprints and a lineup is sticking a needle in a person and taking his or her blood, correct?
I agree it's more intrusive than those, yes.
So I guess that case isn't before us, but this particular rule permits, on less than probable cause, the drawing of a blood sample, which is a very serious intrusion. Correct?
Well, I agree that that's not directly before the court.
Okay.
And we should address that at the appropriate time.
I agree.
If you could just look at footnote 7 in Hall so that we're on the same page, because this is the footnote that has caused me to have pause over whether the standard is so clearly applicable to a buccal swab. And in it, Justice Handler says, we believe that certain types of procedures constitute intrusions that are significantly different from the fingerprinting process. And that he distinguishes, based on this ALI model code of pre-arraignment procedures, which is sprinkled throughout this opinion. It is the basis for the Hall opinion. There are four subsets. The first is fingerprints, palm prints, footprints, body measurements, or other reasonable body surface examinations. Now, you could make an argument, maybe a buccal swab is a body surface examination, I don't know. But B then is procedures to obtain specimens or samples of blood, urine, saliva, there's the ambiguity, hair or fingernails, or other bodily substances that can be obtained by comparable methods. So Hall, while it was dealing with a lineup, which it analogized to fingerprinting, doesn't clearly say that standard would apply in all situations. So we are now in another sphere, I think.
I do think that's fair, but then the rule 3584 came as a reaction to this, mm-hmm. and so I think that the if your question is should the standard be lower, am I understanding your Honor's question?
Should the standard be higher for a buccal swab?
Higher than fingerprints, yeah. Or higher than
higher than what the rule currently says.
Right. Is B constant? The question is B constant? And I don't even know that this issue is before us, but is B constitutional, something less than probable cause mm-hmm. for the taking of a buccal swab,
mm-hmm.
Buccal swab?
I don't think that that's correctly before the court as of right now. I do think that B is constitutional, and if Your Honors would like additional briefing on that, I'd be happy to do that. But I think as of right now, that question's not really before the court, because really we're focusing on the appellate panel focused on D.
Understood. Thank you.
And not been raised, and no constitutional issue's been raised.
Correct.
Here.
Right.
I think we have your position. Anything you wanted to add?
I think that covers it. Thank you.
Mr. Keenan.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The ultimate test of the constitutionality of a search is reasonableness. Reasonableness is determined by measuring the need of the state versus the privacy interest of the individual and the level of intrusion on that individual. Admittedly, the privacy interest is lower, being that my client is incarcerated. And the intrusion is not a great one, but nevertheless, the state's need for this evidence is non-existent.
What would be a more unreasonable intrusion on your client's liberty interest than to be wrongly arrested?
That certainly would be an invasion, wrongful arrest. But if that occurred,
and the state is arguing, we don't want to wrongly arrest someone. That's the reason why we're doing this confirmatory test. Like, what's the problem?
I mean, that's correct. And my client could volunteer to produce an additional DNA sample if he felt that was in his interest. But in this case,
but if he didn't,
feel
he
like
wouldn't.
It's in his interest.
If he didn't feel it was in his interest, he wouldn't volunteer. So we'd be where we are today.
We are, and he feels that it would be in his interest to pursue the current.
Are you willing to stipulate that the CODIS sample will be admissible in trial?
No.
Why not? Are you saying that they can't do the test before? Then you want them to arrest him, indict him, and then what? Then you want them to test your client? Otherwise, you're going to object to the CODIS? I'm trying to figure out the whole sense of this.
So the reason we have a problem here in the first place, and it's just been discussed here, is because the state is determined to mail in these samples. Had the state maintained the sample in the data bank, which the statute provides for, they would have the sample already, and there would be no chain of custody problem to begin with. We talk about whether...
What should the state have done? Say that again.
Hand deliver the sample and maintain the chain of custody of the sample.
All 10 to 15,000 of them?
I mean, not every sample needs to be delivered.
How would you know that until you had a situation like this? You wouldn't know ahead of time. So you would have to hand deliver every single sample, all 10,000, 15,000 we have.
Not individually. Obviously, they would collect a number of samples on a weekly basis. Each county could drive the samples into the
state. They don't want to wait. They're saying if they wait, there may be some crime that will go unsolved. They're saying that is not a reasonable option, waiting weeks or months to deliver that to the lab.
But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about samples that are taken, uploaded into the CODIS database. These are after somebody's been convicted, okay? So these samples
are
different.
They may be convicted of one offense, but they may have committed five other offenses that are unsolved. That's what they're saying, or arrested. That's the reason why they want to upload it, no?
I mean, the samples do get uploaded into the CODIS after there's analysis. This isn't.
But you would if this case went to trial under this current circumstance and they were trying to rely on this, you would be, I'm sure, with your experience and skill representing your client, you would be all over that. you would be arguing that this stays out, this, there's no proper chain of custody. You would, I would suggest, probably be arguing beyond the hand delivery transportation issue that there's no chain of custody beyond that provided. And you'd probably win that argument, wouldn't you?
I mean, essentially, though, this is the state's choice in the way to do this. And I'm arguing that this is not practical. The delay of a week of delivering the sample isn't going to significantly speed up the process by which these samples need to be analyzed and uploaded into
space. Do you have any statistics on how many were delivered a week if you waited a week rather than each individual sample?
I mean, I don't have access to those statistics because that's just...
So we really don't know if it would be any help whatsoever. We still may have 5,000 trips up to the lab by different counties.
I mean, if each county made a weekly trip to the lab, that wouldn't be overly burdensome and wouldn't delay the process unduly.
That's about 300 a week.
But, I mean, if you're talking about...
And most of them would come out of Essex, so it would certainly be somewhat burdensome to Essex, which has one of the highest crime rates.
Well, if they're doing it on a weekly basis, the number of samples wouldn't matter. They would be making 52 trips.
So we understand your point. They should figure out a way to hand deliver it. How do you deal with the fact that the federal authorities are insisting on a second test?
With regard to the second test, I have a real question as to whether that's really required by the federal authorities. My reading of the manual indicates that what we received back in this CODIS-IT indicates that they've already confirmed the sample, because you can't release the personally identified information unless there's actually a confirmed sample. So my reading and the fact that we got this confirmed hit with the personally identified information indicates that the sample has already been confirmed. You look at Section 6 of the manual, it doesn't come until the end as a follow-up to the whole procedure after there's been a confirmed hit that you actually get to the point where they're requesting a new sample to, just as a belt suspenders kind of way of making sure that everything was okay.
Do you dispute that that's their requirement? I'm looking at 6.1.3.5. Isn't that what they said?
I have to take a look at that.
That NDIS shall inform the local law enforcement agency, quote, of the need for a legally obtained sample from the offender. We're talking about an additional sample here, no?
Yeah, that's the follow-up procedure I was talking
about. So assume you persuaded the prosecutor's offices to hand deliver these items. How do you get beyond this?
I don't know that this is a requirement, because you have situations where, imagine if the person who's suspected is deceased. You couldn't get a sample from that person. Or if the person is on the lam in the wind, you can't get a sample there.
If the person is what?
On the lam.
On the wind. Yeah, on, you know.
On the lam. Okay.
Can't find
it's a colloquial one.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Sorry.
In the wind.
But it also says that they need to obtain a legally obtained sample, and if this court determines that it's not legal at this point to obtain the sample, it can't possibly be a problem for this provision.
Has this come up elsewhere, the same question that the state responded to? In federal case law, in federal investigations, in other states, has this process of obtaining a second sample been challenged in the way that you are now? Is there law that supports your position?
Not to my knowledge, but I'll note that in O'Hagan, this court proved the overall scheme of DNA collection, based on this notion that there would be a one-time collection of DNA. Mm-hmm. Now we wouldn't have to repeatedly go back. And under the arguments of the state, we would have to get confirmatory samples every time there's a hit on from DNA. So this is not the one-time collection that was envisioned. And also, the statute itself provides for the fact that we're not going to be taking repeated samples from people. And if this was really a necessary part of the whole DNA scheme, the statute itself should have provided for that instead of doing the opposite and saying we can only take DNA from individuals at one point.
So if they got a warrant, would you have any argument? They had probable cause. They could have gotten a warrant here. They had probable cause.
I mean, I disagree that there's probable cause here to begin with, but
okay.
I could address that as well.
Assume that there is probable cause and they secured a warrant, would you have any argument?
I mean, there would be argument as to reasonableness. If they've taken DNA already, DNA is immutable, they have the sample, And in fact, they can go back and retest that sample because the physical sample itself is retained in the state's DNA data bank, different from the database where the actual like electronic record is kept.
But you're still going to run into CODIS finding a lack of, they're looking for a second sample.
Yeah, that
and if the state police lab sends them a sample that's the same one they already had, I think it's fair to get to assume they're going to say no, we need a new legally obtained sample.
Right, and there are circumstances where that's just not possible. So noted.
But you're saying it shouldn't be possible. Period. You're saying there's no probable cause if there's a CODIS hit. You're saying that they can't do this under the rule. You're basically saying that they can't, that the state is in a position where it cannot comply with a federal requirement, which is protective, among other things, of innocent defendants, to obtain a confirmatory sample that's evidential. That's your position.
Under circumstances where, you know, they're under the analysis in O'Hagan, given if there was a requirement that there had to be two samples taken in order for this process to be fully secure, and we have a notion that, you know, this is going to work and produce the expected results. If that was provided for in the statute, then certainly you could get, you know, two samples from a defendant.
What do you make of 53.1-20.20i? That specifically says nothing in this act shall be deemed to limit or preclude collection of DNA samples as authorized by court order or in accordance with any other law.
True,
so if you get a court order, why can't you get a second sample?
I'm not saying it's impossible to get a second sample. I'm saying that would be subject to the normal analysis of probable cause and whether it was reasonable under the circumstances to get a second sample.
Okay, so you're not saying that the availability of a court order under this rule is out of question.
No.
Okay.
No. And I think that issue with regard to saying that this act doesn't restrict the court order for additional sample or for getting a DNA sample would primarily go to cases where the individual isn't in CODIS, and there's a sample where you have an instance where there's a DNA in an item, and then there's a suspect who's not in CODIS. In that situation, you can get a court order to get DNA samples.
I don't understand your answer to my question then. I was asking you about the CODIS system because this is, you're citing to 20-23 to say you can't get a second sample. I pointed to I, which says you can get a second sample under a judicial order, and now you're back saying you can't get one? I don't understand.
I'm sorry. No, I'm saying that in the situation I was explaining was with regard to an individual who was not in CODIS. So you have a statute talking about saying this statute shouldn't be read as restricting court orders for DNA samples.
So you're saying that that the court order in that provision doesn't apply if this is a non-CODIS hit?
Right, so
you're saying that's what it's for.
Non-CODIS hits.
Non-CODIS hits.
Yes.
So we're back to saying there is no route. You're saying there is no route for the state to get the sample that's required by CODIS that either confirms the hit or contravenes the original CODIS hit and therefore exonerates your client potentially. So that's what you're saying.
My reading of the statute encompassed that original notion of, you know, the defendant not being in CODIS. I'm not saying that that's the only thing it precludes. It could be read as also saying that.
So you're the solution you're offering for this. I understand you're representing your client and good advocacy. But the solution for the state is to go do your hand delivery of 15,000 samples. And by the way, CODIS is going to tell you, this isn't what we want. We want a new sample. It's right in our manual. So that's respectfully, does that seem like a fair and reasonable solution?
I mean, I do. If you have the entire purpose of this database is to accurately identify individuals, and then you're going to say that we're going to not care about, you know, the information we're putting into the database in the first place. We're not going to be secure about that. We're going to do it in a slipshod manner that the state explains that how it's occurring in jails and winds could blow in and things could get messed up. I mean, that's defeating the entire purpose of the database. You know, garbage in, garbage out.
No, it's not. You send a DNA sample. You have no idea who the target is. And CODIS pops it up and says,
it's this person you never saw of, you never heard of, you didn't know was in the state. What? Now you got something. Now you got to further explore, and they're saying, give us, they're going to be, literally, there are 12 to 15,000 a year like that, and you've decided that's not a problem? More than a problem.
It's a problem when you're putting inaccurate information
into
the database.
As far as we know, it's never been inaccurate. But you're going to challenge it. You're going to challenge chain of custody. And their problem is not, is it accurate or inaccurate? Is, am I going to get it into court? Am I going to use it as a basis to arrest somebody, not take a buccal swab, put them in jail? And they are trying to make sure to protect innocent defendants. And you're saying, well, that doesn't matter.
Well, either the information is accurate or not. If we're saying that the information contained in the CODIS database is accurate, then there's no problem.
There's an evidentiary problem.
Are you willing to admit that? There's an evidentiary issue. If it shows up in CODIS, we're not disputing chain of custody. You just told Justice Albin, oh, no, things can happen. So you're saying they have to now take 12, 15,000 samples a year, ship them up to the lab, figure out a way, I guess, to store them. And if you send them up to CODIS, you might have to give them a second sample anyway. But you'll save enough to... And that's your suggestion.
I mean, either the samples that are being provided to CODIS are accurate or not. If their contention is that it's accurate...
But there's such a thing, and good lawyers do it all the time, as accurate but inadmissible samples. I mean, it's a technical requirement to lay a foundation for the admissibility of a DNA sample. And you would be, I'm sure, the first to point out defects in that, even if it turns out to be an accurate sample, in order to keep that out, in order to protect your client. There's nothing wrong with that. So saying they must be inaccurate if they're concerned about chain of custody, it assumes that you would stipulate to the admissibility of an accurate sample, and you've already said you won't.
There's a difference between, you know, what's going to occur at trial. Naturally, the defendant is going to require that there'll be a chain of custody.
Of course.
But the state is saying that the information, we can't rely on that information to arrest the client.
So think about what you're talking about. Let's talk about this case. Let's get really concrete. You're conceding they can arrest your client and indict your client based upon the CODIS, correct? Correct? They have a hit. They have probable cause. Can you accept that? Okay, assume it. If you don't want to concede it,
based on the information.
Assume that the DNA from CODIS matches your client on the glove. Okay, they're going to indict your client. You don't want a confirmatory before, but now when you're at trial, because they're going to be able to do this, you're not going to. You're going to object to that. No chain of custody. You get it from my client's mouth.
They can get the...
Right? Am I correct about the way this is going to go forward?
I don't think so. I think
no?
That...
Tell me where I'm wrong.
So, at the point of arrest, as the appellate division noted, there's a lower expectation of privacy. There are searches that are occurring at that point. At that point, it would be a much better argument for the state to get their DNA sample at that point.
You're not arrested. You're agreeing with Justice Albin. Forget the intrusion of a swab before you arrest him to make sure he's the guy you want to indict and arrest. Arrest him, swab him, and then you got what you want.
Well, they're already sure.
I'm sure that's a lot easier than run 15 or 20,000 samples up to the lab, personally. You wouldn't arrest anybody because everybody would be on the street going back and forth to Trenton.
I disagree with that. I think that, as I noted, that if this was
a weekly delivery,
I don't think that's overly burdensome. And it's just to assure that we don't have the problems that are described by the state to get an accurate database. You know, ultimately, like, if this is not an accurate database, as they're contending, then...
Nobody contends it's not an accurate database. You're contending that it's inaccurate because you can't prove chain of custody.
It's in the state's brief that they're saying that these things could occur, therefore...
But I heard the AG specifically say, as far as I know, it's never been shown to be inaccurate. It's never been disproven. I don't take from anything they said in the brief that it's inaccurate. What they're saying is you're going to challenge chain of custody. You acknowledge, and you think that hurts the underpinnings of the CODIS hit.
But if they're so sure that it's accurate, then what's the question that's going to be resolved by new It's only for the chain of custody.
Getting it into evidence.
That's
because
right.
Because a DNA match is, so is saying, very nice to have.
How do you advise your client? I could see your client before you, and this is your advice to him. You can get swabbed before indictment or after indictment. If they try to swab you before indictment, I have some legal arguments. But if it's after indictment and you're going to be indicted, they're going to be able to swab you. Like, what would you prefer? Wouldn't you think the defendant would prefer to be swabbed before, just in case it's wrong?
I think that's the question for the client to determine himself. Okay. I mean, it shouldn't be forced on him. You know, it's his ultimate decision whether he wants to go that way or not.
Do you agree that the intrusion of arrest is greater than the intrusion of a swab, detention and swab?
Yes.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you to articulate for us the standard that must be shown. Is 3-5A-4 sufficient to get a buccal swab?
No, it's not.
Tell us.
Buccal swab is a search, as this court has held in Gathers. As Justice LaVecchia noted, the Hall decision does reference in footnote 7 that it would not, citing a federal case where there was a blood sample taken, that it distinguishes those sorts of situations and further cites the ALI different categories where saliva is categorized with a blood sample.
So we know the search has to be reasonable.
Tell us
what language in Gathers, Hall, or elsewhere you're relying on to say that it has to be a demonstration of probable cause.
I think in Gathers they specifically stated that there was a probable cause requirement that needed to be met. I don't have the particular slight offhand, but it's noted throughout that in constitutional terms, this is a search, and we've always required probable cause for search.
Have you raised this issue? Is this issue before us, the constitutionality of B?
We've raised the issue with regard to, whether, in a sense, we have, with regard to the probable cause standard. So I've argued that the probable cause standard needs to be met in this case.
My question to you is, has anyone questioned whether or not, in this case, B is sufficient under either our state or federal constitution?
I don't think it's sufficient.
I understand you don't think it's sufficient now. I'm asking you, has it been raised in the trial court and the appellate division?
I argue that the probable cause standard needed to be met here. I didn't specifically say that, B is unconstitutional, but I argue that...
Have you argued that there isn't probable cause in this case?
Yes, absolutely. And with regard to that issue, looking back to Gathers again, we have this very similar situation here where we have a police officer 3 years after the initial investigation who's not one of the original investigating officers stating, without citing a basis of knowledge, what occurred. And all the critical pieces of information come from this second and third person hearsay of what other officers investigated, and the certified or the affidavit officer never states that he read a police report or spoke to a police officer to get that information. So he's got no basis of knowledge for that officer's affidavit. This court in Gathers found that to be insufficient. So all the critical information...
Because they didn't have DNA from the gun. They have DNA from the gloves, unlike Gather. So they know there's DNA. And frankly, they know CODIS identified the defendant as the person whose DNA was in the glove. That's a lot different than Gather's.
It's a very different case than Gather's.
There's a lot more probable cause in this than there was in Gather's.
But all the critical information linking the glove to the commission of the crime is based on those statements from the officer who interviewed the witness. So without the witness's testimony that the suspect threw the glove into the garbage can, it doesn't have any connection to any crime. So just saying that we have a glove that matches, that has DNA matching my client, without the statement from the witness saying that I saw this person running through my yard after I heard
a
warrant.
That's more than Gathers. I mean, Gathers just found the gun in the area where they thought a shooting had occurred. They didn't even identify the gun to the defendant.
Right, but there's no.
And they certainly didn't know if there was DNA on the gun.
But there's no link.
You know, there's DNA here.
And a crime here without the testimony.
True.
So So that's essential.
True. And that's probable cause can be based on an eyewitness.
Right? But there's no indication that the officer here spoke to any eyewitness or spoke to even the officers who talked to the eyewitness or even read a police report. I remember watching the argument in Gathers, and that was the very problem that was, there was no basis of knowledge here.
It was a prosecutor who talked to a police officer who talked to a witness. We didn't say no hearsay can be used.
Hearsay can be used, absolutely, but there needs to be a basis of knowledge for that hearsay.
I get your point.
In addition, you know, I also talked about in my brief that this is touch DNA and what the significance of touch DNA being found on a glove in a garbage can and ease at which touch DNA can be transferred between different things. And without in the affidavit stating the number of profiles that were taken off that glove and the number of CODIS hits that came back, you can't really evaluate whether there's probable cause here. Because, for example, if there was 10 different DNA profiles lifted off that glove, we got 5 CODIS hits, you couldn't possibly say that there's probable cause to believe that my client was the one who was wearing those gloves versus some of his skin cells being in the garbage can from various, you know, other means.
Aren't you asking for a higher standard than probable cause with that argument?
Absolutely.
Probable cause is more likely than not.
More likely than not. So if you have two people, for example, who have, you get 2 hits back, how can you possibly say that one person is more likely than not than the other to have committed the crime? You can't. It'd be completely arbitrary to say this one did it and that one didn't.
But isn't it probable cause to search, not probable cause to arrest, which has to find more likely than not the evidence of criminality is going to be found upon a search of the item that you're looking for?
Right.
Right? You don't have to prove that this person committed the crime, just that further evidence in the investigation can be provided.
Yeah, I thought a lot about that distinction.
That distinction was made in Chippewa.
Yeah, but in here, in this case, what's being searched is identity. So it's really synonymous. So like when you're doing a search for the identity of the individual versus a search for a gun that might contribute to probable cause that the individual committed a crime, here we're just looking to identify the individual, and that identity itself then will connect to the other evidence that the state has. So it's really essentially the same thing in this case.
Anything you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Dean, brief rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. The state would like to address the defense's argument with respect to the assertion that prosecutors' offices or the local jails should somehow hold on to these DNA samples for weeks and deliver them all at one time. But what the defense is proposing is another regulatory scheme by which the jail has to keep track of this information, which in and of itself is susceptible to error. So we're introducing another element that could potentially be causing error, as opposed to what we have though now, which is the detective literally takes the sample from the defendant himself and drives that over to the NJCP, which is as ironclad as it can get with respect to chain of custody. We're talking about using more resources, which is a concern that we have originally with respect to keeping track of these 15,000 samples that'll be held at some point within our offices. And also, when we talk about the NDIS manual itself, even if we hold on to these samples and we document them, there is some it's not entirely clear, but the manual under 6.1.3.5 specifically notes that there must be the casework laboratory can then perform DNA analysis on the newly obtained known biological sample submitted by the law enforcement agency. So there is some question as to whether or not, if we on our own keep a sample on hand, whether that will be good enough for the FBI's purpose. Now, only the FBI could answer that question, but if it wasn't, then that would defeat the state's purpose, and I don't think it would run afoul of our Constitution.
It really suggests, the way that it is worded suggests that if you tried to do that, they would politely tell you, you got this, you didn't read our manual correctly. We need
that seems to be the case.
Legally obtained new sample thank you very much, we'll hear from you.
Correct. And we don't know to what extent the FBI would be strict in upholding this particular subsection, but if we read it as is, it seems to implicate that there must be a new sample taken pursuant this way. And it may be they want to establish some form of uniformity along all 50 states so that nobody's going off and creating their own procedures which are susceptible to error and which could potentially compromise the integrity of the CODIS system, which we get audited on the CODIS system, whether or not we're complying specifically with the manual. If that audit reveals that we're going rogue on certain aspects, we could lose our accreditation, we could lose our ability to access the database, which obviously is a situation everyone wishes to avoid.
Is the constitutionality of B in the rule before us?
No, it is not. As the state pointed out in its reply brief, the defense did not cross appeal on that issue. The appellate division said that the state satisfied A, B, and C of the Rule 358-4. So to the extent that that argument has been raised, it is not properly before this court. Perhaps in a future case, that query can be briefed and properly discussed would be more appropriate. With respect to the defense's argument that that Gaithers is distinguishable from this case with respect to the basis of knowledge, as I think Justice Solomon was indicating, Gaithers was talking about an assistant prosecutor simply talking hearsay statements without any idea of where he's getting this information from. In contrast, in this case, we submitted an affidavit from our lead detective on the case. There's even an indication from the lead detective that he personally spoke with the CODIS personnel who told him where they got the glove from. So he's established his firsthand knowledge. We're here under not under a search warrant context. We're here under the investigative detention context, which arguably is a lower standard. Whether or not that's the case, that can be explicated under future state. But it was Judge Daniels' ability to draw that inference that this officer, as a law enforcement personnel, had a basis of knowledge for the statements he's making, and it was a reasonable inference. And so the court's properly decided that subsection B was properly held. And lastly, the state would like to leave this court with the defense's argument somehow that this decision should be left to the suspect himself to determine whether or not he gets a buccal swab. And there's an important policy argument, I think, underlying this situation. It's not necessarily grounded in law, but as a practical matter, when we're talking about the CODIS database, by definition, we're talking about people who have either been convicted of a crime or arrested for a serious offense. So they've all had, arguably, what they would consider a negative experience with the criminal justice system. A lot of them may have had consent samples, consent searches or statements used against them. But that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be afforded a standard procedural safeguard against wrongful arrest, which is what we're talking about here. The state is seeking to enforce a mandatory procedural safeguard which will ensure that we have the right person here, that we make the right arrest before, and we act on our evidence only after we test it, which we have to do in any course during the course of the investigation. Whether before arrest or after arrest, it needs to be done. It only makes rational sense to do it before.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement. Anyone need a break?